Now on News Talk, as part of our winter season of documentary on News Talk, producer Noel Murphy discovers how futuristic technologies are causing us to rewrite our history in Back to the Future, Archaeology Meets Technology.
Archaeology, the study of our past, has been invigorated by the use of modern technologies. These technologies are making us re-evaluate lots of what we thought we knew about our ancient sites and monuments. I want to find out where this is happening and how it is being done, so I'm exploring how archaeology met technology in a journey that will take me back to the future.
Hello, I have an appointment with Dr. Adele Vernock, please.
Come on in, we're at the top of the building.
Thank you.
Dr. Adele Vernock is head of the Discovery Programme, Ireland's leading archaeological research institution based in Dublin. Here, in this somewhat antiquated building, cutting-edge technologies are being used to rewrite history. And I'm about to meet the team to find out how.
Hello, Adele.
How are you?
Aaron is in there.
After Adele introduced me to various members of the team, Gary Devlin explained to me how the Discovery Programme is using lasers to record ancient monuments in precise 3D detail.
This is a couple of final models that we've made from our field work.
So what you're showing me here actually is Newgrange entrance stone.
Yeah.
Which has been completely scanned in, laser scanned in.
Yeah, so this is done with what we call object scanning. This is the highest resolution of laser scanning that we do. So you get the highest level of detail on the stone. So you can
pick out. And the visual that you're showing me now, you're actually zooming in. So this is 3D. You can turn it around. You can look at it from any angle.
Yeah.
You can zoom it right in. It's almost as though I could touch it.
Yeah, so this is all accessible on our website, which is 3dicons.ie.
So anyone can go in and have a look at this?
Yeah, and then if we take it up a scale, here we've got Bishop's Gate. This done with a terrestrial laser scanner. So again, this is a different level of detail, so you're getting like a stone-by-stone record of the monument or structure that you're scanning.
Now, this is a bridge, essentially, a very decorative archway underneath it. So whatever happens in the future to this, there is a full record of it at that date.
At this date, we have an exact detail model.
And even the chips out of the stone steps and each individual stone in the wall is recorded.
Yeah, everything that the scanner sees will be recorded in the detail. Essentially what we do is we traverse around the monument so that we look at it from all the different angles. We use what's called a terrestrial laser scanner, and it's firing off a laser pulse. It's return, it knows the distance that's travelled, and we pick up millions and millions of these points.
So we're sending out millions of pings. These are coming back and digitising something and through the software.
Exactly. So what we end up with is millions of these laser points in XYZ, and then we have to join these together in order to create a surface model that's viewable online.
Before now, how would this have been done?
It would have essentially been meticulously drawn by hand, or else
and you could use... surveyed with measuring tapes.
Surveyed with measuring tapes or total stations, but you're not really picking up as much detail in any way, shape or form than what we get with this modern technology.
With this, you can actually see the textures of the different types of stone, bits of stone that have been worn away with weather.
Exactly.
And that's something you couldn't do if you were measuring and drawing it up. Well...
No, it would take the rest of your lifetime to record enough points to get to this level of detail.
This laser technology can also be used to survey entire landscapes, such as at the Hill of Tara, using a system called LIDAR, involving lasers fixed to airplanes. It creates digital models of such precision, it can reveal ground features that would otherwise be hidden to the eye. Jared Dowling explained the significance of this.
Well, this is really a quantum leap forward in terms of our understanding of previous monuments that were once on the hill. So for instance, you can bring up an extraordinary level of detail onto really low profile or almost invisible monuments. You could walk on the hill and you wouldn't see these features at all. And really it's only from this bird's eye perspective with this really extraordinary detail that you can pick out many of the monuments. So for instance, here you can see
even in terms of previous agricultural activity, all these ridge and furrows here. This is from 18th, 19th century cultivation.
So those little lines, which look like ploughed lines, are actually from a different era.
Yes. And then alongside this, you can see here, for instance, this is what archaeologists call a ring ditch, which is essentially a burial monument.
If you were actually were walking that on the ground, you're not even going to see that.
You would walk over that and you wouldn't realise it was there at all. And it's really with this technology that we can actually get to see them.
So really what you're doing is that you're building layer upon layer of information about a site. So, I mean, Tara probably is the best example, but we've other ones that we've been working on, some monastic sites, where you will look at the historical maps, you will look at the source material, so the references, all the historical references, you will do your geophysical and your scanning, and by building all that up, you're actually building a whole research framework of knowledge and resources, far more than we ever could have thought, 20, 25 years ago.
Is it possible that the work that was done 25 years ago, and even beyond that, very detailed surveys of their day were done, we thought this was what Tara was or other sites, and now we're finding out much, much more. Is it colouring our understanding?
It's completely changing our understanding, completely, because in fact we didn't really know what Tara was 25 years ago.
So far be it from archaeology having all been discovered at this point, could it be said that we really are only at the tip of the iceberg?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think everywhere we go.
Well, I've had a fruitful visit to the Discovery Programme. Next time I meet these guys, we're going to be on a field trip.
This field trip has taken me to Killarney in the Kingdom of Kerry in search of some archaeological treasure. Here I'll again be meeting Gary from the Discovery Programme and also Dr. Nora White of the School of Celtic Studies in the Dublin Institute for Advanced Studies. But mysteriously, they've arranged to meet me after dark at a church ruins in the old cemetery at Ahadoe to look at an ancient Oam stone.
Oam is the earliest form of writing in Ireland, dating back to the 4th century. The Oam alphabet is made up of a series of strokes alongside or across a line, and is sometimes referred to as the Celtic tree alphabet. There are around 400 surviving Oam stones in Ireland, with most of these being in the south of the country, and that's why I've come this evening to a quiet churchyard in County Kerry to see how some of these ancient monuments are being digitised for future generations. We're coming within sight of the Oam stone. So this is the old part of the ruins of the church. Gary, we're looking at this stone now.
Yeah.
You're going to now start the scanning process. What's involved in that?
So the scanning process, we normally do it during the daytime. This is an unusual situation where we're out late at night. What we'd normally do is we've got a forensic blackout tent. We'd set that up over the stone to be recorded. Then we hook the scanner up to the laptop, hook them both up to the generator to give us the power, and then we start the scanning process. What we see when the scanning is in progress is a constant white flashing light. This scanning technology is called structured light. So it's looking for the changes in the returns of this white light, and then it's using trigonometry, but thousands and thousands of times, to record the precise location of particular points.
Having scanned this stone, what can we do with that information?
So once we get the data back, we can create a 3D model of the stone, which we will then put on the internet on our website, Oam in 3D. It's to make these stones more accessible, but also we can take the data and we can use different lightings and shaders and so on to make the inscription clearer and to check if there's anything else there that might have been missed in the past.
This ancient carving, which was done so many centuries ago, which has carried this message as far as now, this means of communication is now expanded beyond the scope of what we could ever have envisaged, because by the time that you've digitized this and put it on the website, it's available for anyone in the world to have a look at it and to look at it in a 3D fashion. So really, the simplicity of these carvings, no one could have predicted how that communication could have expanded.
Absolutely, yeah. I wonder if, you know, how long they thought they would last or if they even thought about that. But yeah,
and in a way, now it will, even despite the fact that it is weathering away here, this message can now, through this technology, well, it can live forever.
Yeah, well, that's one of the reasons for doing it as well, is to have a digital record now, because they are weathering. You know, this is a good way, and it's also a way of monitoring. We can come back and record them again and kind of get an idea of the rate of weathering and the ones that are most in need of attention.
So, Gary, you're carrying out the scanning now with your cross between a hairdryer and an iron.
And an iron, exactly.
And a strobe light.
And a strobe light, yeah.
Anyone in the nearby village looking at us is going to be wondering what's happening in the graveyard at this late hour of the night.
That's it.
I presume that this has to be done in one single sitting, if you like.
So what we can do is we can record it in numerous scans, and then we can digitally align these scans together. It's something called cloud-based registration. Essentially what it's doing is it's looking for the similarities in the two scans and then piecing it together based on the similarities.
So again, the technology will pull these together. Even if you were to come back and finish this tomorrow, which you're not going to do,
yeah.
But you could, the technology will pull them precisely together and join them up.
It would. Or another example of where we can join up scans is, for instance, this stone you can see is split into, it's been broken into three pieces and then reassembled together again. But sometimes what we find are fragments of one stone, and they might be on the site in different locations, and what we can do is digitally piece them stones together again.
So you can, again, using the technology in the 3D world, you can reassemble that stone.
Exactly. So digitally do what you're looking at here. This data, what we're ending up with, is really high resolution data and a 3D model of this stone. But this sort of data can actually be captured now by anyone with a digital camera. So there's something called Structure from Motion. And there's a lot of free software online where anyone can go out and capture this type of data.
So this is becoming more open to ordinary users?
It is. The technology is always getting easier and cheaper to use. Within the next few years, anyone with a smartphone will be able to produce models like these.
Now, as you're doing this on your laptop screen, which is here, it's all starting to come together.
Yeah. Trying not to fall.
You've partially scanned this, but we can already see the structure of it. You can even see the joint lines where this was in three separate pieces. Very, very clearly.
Yeah, they're coming up really clear if you take away the texture.
Yeah, clear disclosure.
Oh, now we can see even more clearly how it was joined
after
it had become broken. A rough enough job was done.
Yeah. So the notches are really clear now in the data.
Now, the fact that we're doing it and in complete darkness now is allowing you to get a more accurate picture.
Where the stone is actually positioned up on this wall, quite high up, the tent that we'd normally use to block out the sunlight wouldn't fit up on this wall, so that's why we've come back at night to do it. After 5-10 minutes, we've now fully captured the stone, so that gets added to our digital collection online, so anyone can access this stone in the next few weeks.
So the process you've used here, this is the most advanced technology that can be used.
Yeah, and one of the benefits of this technology as well is that it's non-invasive. We didn't actually have to physically touch the stone.
You didn't have to move it, you didn't have to adjust it, you didn't have to tamper with it in any way.
No. Fairly dark now.
It sure is, yeah.
Pitch dark.
It got dark.
Yeah.
Our nocturnal adventure means that this Oum stone is now fully recorded in minutest detail for all eternity and for all the world to see. This creates better opportunities to study the messages of these stones and to decipher their linguistics. Now I'm taking my Back to the Future journey to the opposite end of the country to see technology that can reach back 50,000 years.
Radiocarbon dating is a method for determining the age of an object containing organic material. I'm here in Queen's University, Belfast, to find out how new technologies are being applied in this field.
The lab has been in this building since about 1986, but it was a conventional liquid scintillation laboratory. We got funding in 2004 to build a building and buy an accelerator mass spectrometer, which is a new method for dating carbon and uses a very small sample and a small amount of time.
I'm meeting Professor Paula J. Reimer. She's telling me how important carbon dating technology is to archaeology, paleontology, and climatology.
Very important. It's essential to provide a time scale for when these things happened. If you wanted to know, for instance, did Neanderthals go extinct because of human competition, or were they gone by the time humans got here? Well, you couldn't do that without knowing the time in which these first humans appeared and when the Neanderthals disappeared.
The work that you're doing here, who's benefiting from this work? Who is coming to you and looking for this, and how is it helping them?
A large number of archaeologists come to find out how old the skeletons they find in their deposits are, maybe grains and seeds and, you know, you name it, pieces of wood. But also we work a lot with people looking at past climates, and so you can then look at changes in vegetation. But then you need to have a time to say, was this 10,000 years ago we saw this major shift? Was it yesterday? Past climate work is based on knowing what happened in the past, obviously, so that you can decide what needs to be done in the future.
That sort of leads me to another question, where in Ireland, bog bodies have come up again after many years. The problem, initial problem, is how long have they been there? I mean, I think there have been cases of a body or skeletal remains that have appeared, and they're wondering, is this something recent? Has a murder happened here? Only to find that the murder happened maybe hundreds or even thousands of years ago.
Yes, this it happens fairly frequently that we get material from the Garda or the PSNI and are asked to provide a date. Sometimes some skeletons even can look pretty recent and maybe 1,000 years old. Mainly we have less radiation in this lab because the carbon here is older, because we have all of these old bones laying around.
All right, so I'm in a safer environment here than I would be outside.
Yeah, this is our pre-treatment laboratory, so there's a number of steps in preparing carbon samples for dating. The noise is the vacuum pumps running because we want to get rid of all the air in the samples when we seal them into the tubes. We don't want to include air which has carbon dioxide. These have already been combusted. So what's left behind is, you can see some copper, elemental copper that's left behind. Of course, you can't see the carbon dioxide because it's clear.
So where is the sample?
It's gone.
It's all right. It actually disappears during the process.
Yes. These are the numbers on here. Tell us what the sample is, like wood in this case, an arrow shaft, and so forth.
So in that case, an arrow shaft which was picked up on some archaeological dig,
yes,
for example. So how much of that arrow shaft is needed? A little snippet of it?
Yeah, a very small snippet.
A small snippet, and so then that will help tell them when that arrow shaft was created.
Yeah.
Or when it was used.
Yes. Some of these are peat samples, charcoal. Here's a bone root of a horse tooth.
So a whole range of different experiments and work being done.
Yes. Let's go on down here to see the next step. Hi, Julia.
Hello.
So this is where, this is the other rig we have for making graphite using hydrogen. Julia is working with shell samples right now. And instead of combusting shell samples, they're put into phosphoric acid, and that produces CO2 directly.
And of course, like any good lab, I see steam spilling over the edge of some sort of receptacle.
Liquid nitrogen does that, yeah.
So yeah. I don't stick my finger in that?
No. Yeah. Now that's the catalyst that the carbon will form on. So then once that's done, they're pressed into these small holders.
They're like a little screw nail that you would put a clock together with.
Yes, except they've got a hole in the center where you put your sample in. Then we press it down very firmly so that it doesn't fall back out.
So you've taken that sample of arrowhead or horse's tooth, put it through these processes, and now you've packed it into a tiny little capsule.
Yes.
Ready for the final section of the process. Let's go and see that. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on here. Major ducts, huge pieces of machinery, all to deal with a very, very tiny specimen.
That's right. It's a little sample, and they get put into a wheel, and this goes into the accelerator, this wheel.
This is a ring of samples that is ready to go. Incredibly, it's covered in tin foil.
Yes, that's just to keep out dust. Tin foil is good stuff, yeah.
Right, okay, so now we're into the major equipment. The red flashing light over there, nozzles everywhere, and along what looks like a barrel of some super laser weapon.
Okay, it's not a super laser weapon, but what happens is that wheel of samples goes into, we call it the source, and it is accelerated by a voltage down the tubes. And then this is the tank that accelerates them to about 3% of the speed of light, so they're going very, very fast. The carbon-14 goes on around to another detector, which is over here.
So this is the end of the line?
That's the end of the line, yeah. The information comes out here.
All right, so these two screens with a myriad of different sets of information and colors on them. I'm delighted that we still have machines with dials and switches on them.
Yes. There's a newer one that is smaller.
Like all technologies is getting smaller and even quieter.
Yeah, yes, which would be nice.
You're listening to Back to the Future, Archaeology Meets Technology on News Talk 106 to 108.
I'm taking my journey to the ancient royal citadel of Connacht, Rathcrohan, in the heart of Roscommon. Geophysical technologies have been used to probe underneath the soil of this great mound, uncovering an enormous ritual enclosure which shows that it was likely used for great assemblies of people and royal ceremonies. An entire world has been discovered underneath the surface without any digging or destruction. Joe Fennick, Archaeological Field Officer of NUI Galway, has carried out much of the surveying here and brought many students into the archaeological field, and today he's got a new one.
Yeah, this is Rathcrohan Mound. It's the central monument in the whole archaeological complex here. A very substantial flat-topped mound. It's about 90 metres in diameter. It's about 7 metres high. And initially it was thought that it was simply a natural mound that had been scarped to shape to make it circular. But over the course of geophysical surveys here over a number of years, we've discovered that it's very much artificial in construction, built on a natural glacial ridge. But deep within its cores is a series of enclosures, stony enclosures. And more importantly, on top of it, we discovered the remains of a series of concentric circles. And they turned out to be the remains of consecutive building and rebuilding of large-scale temples, temples built long before the coming of Christianity. So what we're looking at here is the ritual focus for a major ceremonial complex prior to the coming of Christianity. We set up a grid, basically a grid is, we replicate, in this instance, Irish National Grid on the ground surface. So when we conduct the survey, we know exactly where each individual point is taken on the ground surface. And during the course of the survey, we take readings at regular intervals along parallel lines so we can then assign them proper coordinates at the end of the day. And this allows us to produce a sort of a composite image of all of that data as a single image, and we can represent that as a grayscale. So you will see it as a finished image in grayscale, high readings black, low readings white.
Okay.
And the principle behind these instruments is pretty simple, really. It's based on Ohm's law. The devices themselves haven't changed significantly over the years, but they've become increasingly sophisticated. You're able to do a far more detailed survey now than you would have 10, even 15 years ago. In addition to that, the software is allowing you to look at the data in a way you'd never been able to look at it before. So it's a matter of really embracing technologies generally used for other disciplines like geology, you know, or even the medical field, for instance, for that matter. And as the new technologies come on board, you find people readily adopt them and apply them in ways that mightn't have been envisaged by those who built the instruments in the first instance. So in this case, this particular resistance meter was designed specifically for archaeological purposes.
Shall we give it a whirl?
We will. I'll turn it on now. Fingers crossed. So now, it's as simple as that. Press start, and away we go.
Okay, so you're pushing the probes essentially every foot and a half?
It is, every 50 centimetres, which is the standard survey measurement increment for Rathcrohan. Now, the closer you take the readings, obviously the more detail you get. So it's quite a labour intensive, but every time you half the distance between readings, you obviously quadruple the number of readings you have to take to cover an area. So it's a compromise between detail and area covered. But because we had the luxury you might say of being a research project, we were able to survey it in more detail than you might normally do if you were trying to do it commercially. So that's one line finished now, so we'll head back down another line here.
Another measuring device detects patterns in the soil's magnetics. The magnetometer is harnessed to the person and hovers over the ground. And it looks something like a Star Wars X-Wing fighter, or perhaps a TV aerial. And it goes almost as fast as one. The X-Fighter, not the TV aerial.
So it's a matter of keeping pace with the instrument. We have each of these traverse lines you can see marked with a coloured marker, and that represents 1 metre increment. So every time it beeps, you have to be at one of those coloured markers. So you know when it gives a double beep at the end, you should be at a blue marker instead of a red marker. So it's just a fail-safe to ensure you're in the right place at the right time as you do the survey. And you could do it in your sleep after a couple of days, you know. You get the pacing, you have the pacing, you don't really need the lines, yeah.
Archaeology does not rely on just one type of technology to tell the whole picture. Often, it's the use of several techniques that, when put together, will give a more dynamic and 3D analysis of these ancient sites and monuments. Today at Rathcrohan, we're also joined by Dr. Paul Nasons, an expert in precision drone surveying using a quadcopter, using remote control and iPhone technology.
So first we switch on the actual remote control, and then we switch on the machine itself. We then have to wait for the machine to establish contact with a minimum of 7 satellites before it can take off. When it has done that, it will have fixed its position on the Earth to within 1 metre, and it will control the entire mission using those satellites, that satellite system, which gives us all our information. And this is our app. We'll turn on our camera feature, and if we have no interference, we will be able to see what the camera sees now in a moment. There.
Okay, so we're looking at what the camera can see, and you're controlling it
from
the remote control.
Yes. Now, what we are doing here is not a normal video or normal still images. We're going to actually plan a mission with this. So what we do then in our app, we swipe to the left here, and this is where we are now in real time.
Okay,
this
we've got
an aerial map.
Yeah.
We want to survey the area over the mound. So what we do is we start to punch in waypoints that will tell the machine where it has to fly. So we'll go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. That is our mission now planned. All we need to do now, if we stand back, I'm just going to press the go button here. The machine will take off. I will then commence the photography and the machine will take a photograph every 3 seconds as it flies its mission. Then it will return and hover over us, awaiting further instructions. And if it doesn't get them, it will come back and land in the same place. So are we ready?
We're ready to go. Lifted up now and it's hovering.
Yes. It's now.
And off it goes.
And
so it's heading to position number one.
Yes. So then I start the photography as soon as it reaches the 30 meter height. We can see the height and the altitude reading on the screen here.
So as I'm looking at it in reality, but then I can look on your screen.
And you can see what it's doing and photographing on the screen. So I'll commence the photography now. And every 3 seconds now, the machine is taking a photograph. But we can also see then, we can see its position on a little diagram here, overlaid on aerial photography. So you can see waypoint one, it has now reached it.
Yes.
And it's now heading to waypoint two.
Oh, I can see it moving in the
distance. At which point it will turn and come back towards us again.
Drones can cover large areas at fixed altitudes and speeds and can be fitted with camera, video and thermal imaging equipment, giving much greater archaeological visibility from the air than ever before.
Okay, so it's approaching us now. You're bringing it in.
Yes. I'll just fly it over us and I'll fly it back. I'm actually going to hand catch it.
Okay, so you brought it right into your hand.
And that is the mission completed.
Mission accomplished.
It's really impressive, isn't it? And what's really nice about that is that we have surveys done in previous years, and because that survey now, which was done only in a few minutes, is using Irish Grid as well, we can superimpose all of our digital surveys on top of that photographic three-dimensional image as well. And so we've got a whole range of information there now that we can layer one on top of the other within a GIS environment.
We have things like Google Earth now, so these technologies can merge with Google Earth,
exactly.
And so we're going to get a much greater and more accurate view of the world than we've ever had before.
Yeah, yes. It's quite extraordinary now what can be done. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like a snowballing effect. All of this information can be coalesced as one and can be integrated as one within an environment like a geographical information system, where you can turn on and off layers as you like. You can create three-dimensional images. You can almost do a virtual excavation based on all those results. And so the potential is enormous for archaeology.
Rathcrochan has yet to reveal all of its secrets. There are likely some left for the next generation to discover. So I want to go and meet some of these future archaeologists.
Today I'm in County Mayo, and I'm going to be checking out the school's Archaeological Remote Sensing Project, or SARS for short. This project is the first of its kind in Ireland. It's been led by an archaeological geophysicist and a community archaeologist.
Well, my name is Kevin Barton. I'm an archaeological geophysicist. I've been doing archaeological geophysics all around Ireland and Norway and England since about 2003. Commercial surveys, research surveys, and latterly very much community-based projects around the country, and working in projects in Meath, Waterford, Roscommon, Wexford, and of course here in Mayo. And there seems very much in the last couple of years a great interest in communities actually doing work for themselves, doing original work, original surveys, finding out more about their local heritage. And they don't have to excavate, they can use remote sensing, which is a non-invasive, non-destructive technique. This project here in Mayo, Schools Archaeological Remote Sensing Project, is a first of its kind in Ireland, using remote sensing with two national schools. And it's been a pleasure working with the two schools. And I've been learning and they've been learning, and hopefully the kids have been learning, and they've been using technology to explore their local cultural heritage.
This field event is taking place at the Museum of Country Life, with students from Park and Mayo Abbey schools exhibiting the studies they have done using simple technologies, including geosurveying and kite photography. Today, they have another chance to try these techniques.
I'll just get some of you to tell me a little bit about the project you did at school, where you had a kite and a camera. So what did you have to do?
We had to measure this mound and split it into sections and
four grids.
Yeah. And what's the thing you put in the ground called?
Oh, I don't know.
Tell me about the kite.
We attached a camera to a kite and we got a bird's eye view pictures of the air, of the mound,
and schools, the village.
Yeah.
Now, what about this mound? Did you discover anything about it, or did you even know that the mound was anything before?
We didn't know it was anything.
We kind of guessed. Yeah, they might be part of like an old building.
All right. Okay.
Like by the measurements and that.
Yeah.
Just like higher readings.
And then there was lower readings.
What type of a building could it possibly have been?
Something for like fire burning.
Yeah,
that's what we thought, because it was
blacksmithing.
Like, Yeah, something like that, because there was a lot of like higher readings for like fire and that. Yeah.
So it turns out there's actually something very old and very interesting right beside the school. And do you think anybody ever really knew about this before?
No, we never noticed really.
So, and possibly nobody in the village might have known about it. So this possibly made quite an interesting discovery.
Yeah.
It was quite
that makes you archaeologists.
Yeah.
This is a hen's nest from the museum handling collection.
All right, okay.
And we're going to make a 3D model of it using photography. So we've got the children taking photographs of it all the way around the outside of it.
All right,
and then we're going to put it into a computer and process the image to make a 3D model.
So they don't necessarily have to come to the museum anymore?
No. If they have all the 3D photographs, they can spin it around and do it themselves, yeah. That's it, yeah.
Now, you're taking part in this by taking photographs. Are you interested in all of the things that you've been showing in archaeology?
Yeah, I'm interested in it, and I think it's very good.
Just explain to me what you're doing.
Well, we're taking pictures of the hen's nest, and we have to go around. And this is an old hen's nest, what they used to have back in the days. So we're told to go around and take pictures of it, and take pictures inside of it and all that.
So inside and outside,
yeah.
And then this is going to get transferred onto computer and turn into a 3D model.
Yep.
Who's going to do that bit of it?
Christy Lawless and Mr. Brown.
My name is Christy Lawless and I'm a local archaeologist, a community archaeologist, a field archaeologist. We are bringing to notice two children the valuable heritage that they have in their own area. The younger children of today, they're not as connected with the landscape as we were. So this project actually brought the children out of the national school into the field to show them what is in their own locality, the artifacts and the monuments and their history and how they came there, how they were constructed, the uses that was made of them in their days. And this is a complete eye-opener to the children. And hopefully this experience that we are sharing with the two national schools will go into their permanent memory, and it will be resurrected, I'm sure, in later life, and probably when they go to university, and maybe help them to go in different directions in their careers.
Okay. Now on the blue marks, that's it, and then in the middle again, just there, maybe not so far next time. Let's try it on the blue this time again, on the blue. Okay, got it? Now in the middle now, just about there, so. About there, that's perfect, yep. Okay, now onto the red.
Yep.
Okay.
Good. Now just into the middle there. Okay. And then onto the blue. That's it. Nice. And into the middle again, between the two.
So Kevin, tell me what's going on here now.
The children from Park School are doing an earth resistance survey on a grid that we put... went too early. Give it a little push into the ground. That's it. Wait for the two beats. Now, on you go. They're doing an earth resistance survey in the grounds here of Turner Park House. And this survey is looking to see if there's any buried ditches or walls beneath the surface. And we're collecting the information on a grid here, and we display the information using a computer program, and we look for patterns in the data that might show us where there might be a buried wall or a buried ditch. And if we have, then we've discovered a new archaeological feature. Okay, we're going to go down with the kite now, so okay.
Chrissy, you're getting ready to put the kite up.
I am, but the breeze is very, very light. It's not strong enough yet.
Not strong enough. We give it another.
It's not strong enough. No, it's just too light. You're looking at the leaves on the trees now, and there's hardly a budge.
Coming
in them.
From behind me. Here,
yeah.
The wind conditions are a little bit on the light side, but John Campbell is persevering. This is the second time he's tried to fly the kite, but he's got it up fairly well at the moment. He's going to bring it down a little bit lower, hook on the camera, and then hopefully go up again, and he'll take some aerial shots of Turner Park House and the area around the gardens here and the museum and so on. So that's the plan. He's just checking. The wind conditions are fairly stable. The kite's not moving around too much. We'll just see what he wants to do. I might go over and give him a hand and hold the kite while he gets the camera organised.
Now it started to rain, but here's the chance to get the camera fixed onto the kite line. The kite is up. Mm-hmm. You've dropped the line down here and you're fixing the camera to it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about to go up and take a few images around Turlock House.
Mm-hmm. A few settings to change on the camera. This is just a standard camera you'd buy in any shop. You set it to take shots, continuous shots. You hear it clicking away there.
So it's clicking and it's clicking. About to go up.
And away she goes.
Away it goes, up on the kite string, about halfway up.
Good stable
air. Good and stable now. See if you can get a few pictures of the house itself. So what John is now going to do is just walk up and down on lines so he can scan the ground and scan the area, so you'll get a whole series of different overlapping pictures. It's very simple equipment, probably less than 100 euros to put this package together with a line camera, but it's just amazing what you can do with very basic equipment.
It's a task that you can do that is actually fun.
It's fun, of course, yes. Archaeology is fun, you know. Yep.
How valuable and how important is all of this type of work to our history and to our ongoing identity?
Hugely. These days we have discussions about the identities of peoples or nations, or in our case an island. A lot of nations or peoples understand the value of something like this as a rooting your identity. I think we need to think about that far more in Ireland. We have an enormous amount of archaeology, history and so on, and I don't think we realise how much we have. Sometimes it's always packaged as part of how it will add to the tourism industry, for example. But there is also the more sort of esoteric or philosophical side to this, is knowing, building up the knowledge of our own past and doing it in a very sort of rich way. And as I said, the interaction between people with different skills.
I've taken a journey north, south, east and west to see how futuristic technologies are reaching deeper into our past than ever before. These technologies are allowing us to see beyond what is visible and uncovering secrets which have lain like slumbering giants for thousands and thousands of years. I've seen technologies which can send data all over the world to projects created in local schoolyards. I've met people who have advanced and pushed these technologies over the past 25 years, and I think I've met some of those who will push these technologies further in the next 25.
Back to the Future, Archaeology Meets Technology was produced, presented and edited by Noel Murphy, mastering by John Davis. The project was supported by a grant from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. To listen back to this or any other News Talk documentary, go to newstalk.com/documentary on News Talk.